The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic and the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or any other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. In our last episode of Armchair Traveler, we featured part one of the cover story from the March 2022 issue of National Geographic, titled Into the Depths. Now, this story is about searching for shipwrecks from slavery's hidden past to help heal the present. And we learned about a group of predominantly black explorers who seek to document some of the thousands of slave ships that wrecked in the Atlantic Ocean. Now, today in part two, we're going to begin with an article from the May 1st, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer, Diving Project Helps Black Woman Connect with Her Roots. Writer Liz Johnson of the UNC Media Lab reintroduces us to the writer of the National Geographic article and provides background that will help us continue our journey from part one to part two. So let us grab the N and O here, and we begin now. Every summer until she was about 16, Tara Roberts and her mom drove 8 hours from the city energy of Atlanta to the muggy calm of rural Edenton, a small town on the North Carolina coast. During these visits, Roberts passed the time playing outside with her cousins on their grandmother's large Edenton estate, but she longed to be back in Atlanta. Edenton was hot and mosquito-y, and with too many cornfields and not enough people. Plus, there could be snakes. I never tapped into the magic of that area at all, Roberts said, but in 2021, a journey that had taken Roberts around the globe and deep into history brought her back to Edenton. This time, it felt more like home than she had ever imagined possible. National Geographic cover. This March, Roberts became the first black woman National Geographic Explorer to be featured on the cover of the magazine. National Geographic Explorers receive funding and support to tell stories and educate others about the aspects of the about an aspect of the world. Now, the cover story, along with a six-episode podcast called Into the Depths, is the culmination of about 4 years spent researching and scuba diving alongside members of nonprofit organization called Diving with a Purpose, or DWP. Founded in 2003 and composed primarily of black scuba divers and archaeologists, Diving with a Purpose's primary mission is to train scuba divers to help maritime archaeologists find and preserve underwater artifacts. In particular, the group aims to bring to the surface stories of the slave ships that wrecked on the way from Africa to the Americas. DWP's mission is to tell the story of the African diaspora through our lens, said Ken Stewart, founder and program director of DWP. There are very few black archaeologists in this country, he said. Roberts' first glimpse of DWP came in 2017 at the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington. The image of a crew of scuba divers, almost all of them black, all of them black women, caught her attention. Dazzled by their presence in a field where black women are historically underrepresented and moved by Diving with a Purpose's mission, Roberts contacted Stewart. She wanted to join them. She wanted to tell their story. Questions of belonging. For Roberts, this journey was multifaceted. She wanted to celebrate the work of the DWP team and help shed light on a long-overlooked piece of history. But she also carried with her personal questions of heritage and belonging. Roberts had always loved to travel, living in 8 different cities worldwide in the past 15 years. But in all this traveling, she had never found a place where she felt like she truly belonged. I think I had settled into this feeling of being rootless, but I won't say that I settled into that comfortably, Roberts said. There was a part of me that wanted to be rooted. When Roberts first saw the photo of the black women divers, she was living in Washington and working as a communications director. Throughout her career, she's held editor positions at Cosmo Girl, Essence, and Ebony magazines. Stewart and lead instructor Kamu Siddiqui were surprised when Roberts said she wanted to quit her job to dive and travel with them. They get calls from journalists pretty frequently, but none have matched Roberts' determination and passion. She was committed, she was focused, and she was also sacrificial. She quit her job and said, "This is what I need to do," Siddiqui said. She felt some sort of connection to all these unanswered questions in her own personal quest. This quest took Roberts from a training pool in Washington, D.C., to Mozambique Island, from South Africa to Costa Rica, from Togo and to Benin to Alabama. In Into the Depths podcast, Roberts focuses on the stories of four shipwrecks, the São José Paquete de Africa, the Fredericus Quartus, and the Christianus Quintus and the Clotilde. Tara has visited these different spaces and documented the work that DWP is doing, but also local efforts that have been ongoing in those spaces for cultural preservation efforts, said DWP diving instructor and board member Ayana Flewellen. In each place she visited, Roberts talked to locals and archaeologists, asking them the questions she'd been turning over in her mind, questions of identity, of closure, of remembering a difficult past and celebrating resilience. In Togo and Benin, where her ancestors may have lived, Roberts reconsidered her assumptions about how her identity as a Black American and her uncertain ancestry influences her sense of self. In South Africa, she danced under the stars to music new and old from around the world. In Costa Rica, she worked with local archaeologists and advocates who involve younger generations in the field of maritime archaeology, working as a community to uncover the history that lies just off the shores. A theme that emerged from all these places was the emphasis on communities taking part in the uncovering and sharing of their ancestors' stories. A return to North Carolina. The more time Roberts spent connecting with the history of the African diaspora and considering what it means to be rooted, the more she wondered about her own roots. How far back could she trace her family's lineage in North Carolina? Could learning the history help her understand her own place in the world? In 2021, Roberts made her way back to Edenton for the first time in years. With the help of a Virginia-based genealogist named Renate Yarbrough Sanders, she discovered more about her great-great-grandfather Jack Roberts, her earliest known ancestor. So there you go. That's kind of the premise from that article. We're going to continue that article a little later, but right now we're going to conclude Tara Roberts' essay, Hidden No More, the featured article in the March 2022 National Geographic cover story, Into the Depths. Now, at the end of part one, Roberts writes, "I feel this intense, desperate, crushing longing to know my own family's history." And so now we're going to begin with part two of her article. I hire genealogist Renate Yarbrough Sanders, who specializes in African ancestry research, and ask whether she can help me trace my family back to a slave ship. "I don't ever like to say it's never going to happen," she says, but she shakes her head. "It's not realistic." Yarbrough Sanders says she will try to find out what she can about my earliest known ancestor, my great-great-grandfather, Jack Roberts, who was born enslaved in 1837. My mom has a picture of Grandpa Jack and his wife Mary. They are handsome. He has white cropped hair and neatly trimmed white goatee, and she has on a bow tie. Jack has these soft brown eyes. They are kind eyes. I think I might have liked to gather at his knee and hear his stories. While I wait for a call, I decide to drive from my home in Atlanta to my family's hometown, Edenton, in Chowan County, North Carolina. My mom and her 13 brothers and sisters grew up in a big house with columns and a porch out in the country. The house is still there and still in the family, but it is in a state. There's a big hole in the side wall, a hole I can actually walk through if I bend my leg and stoop down. The windows are broken. There is mold on the walls. Plaster and debris are everywhere. When I used to visit as a kid, my impression of the place was miles of cornfields and lazy quiet, only the droning of bees and singing of crickets to bring up the monotony of the day. The oppressive weight of the silent country rested upon my shoulders back then, and it depressed me to come back here. I get out of my car and stand on the property, looking around and watching the landscaper, Joseph Beasley, tend the yard, poking at weeds. I ask him about the fields. "These little plants, those are soybeans," he says. "You see that dark green stuff way back yonder? That's corn, and right across the edge there." I don't know why this just dawns on me now, but my grandfather, who had only a fourth-grade education, managed to buy this house, a former plantation of an enslaver, and about 100 acres of land in the 1930s. makes me realize I've probably missed even more about my family's legacy. I book a room at a bed and breakfast on North Broad Street in downtown Edenton, which is considered one of the loveliest small towns in the South, largely because of this area. The town sits right on the Albemarle Sound. Colonial mansions that likely housed enslaved people or profited from the business of plantations rise majestically above lines of trees on carefully tended lawns. In all my years coming to my grandparents' house, this is probably the second or third time that I have ever set foot downtown. I expect ignorance, subtle racism, and intentional erasure of the complexity of the past, but I am surprised. Friendly people wave at me as I cross streets. Shop owners and waitresses chat me up. The twang of the Deep South rings pleasantly in my ears. As I walk around, I meet a black birder walking his dog who tells me about a local church's reconciliation group, a forum for both the victims and benefactors of an unjust society to tell their stories, that meets every Thursday. Historical markers to African-American rebellion and accomplishment line sidewalks not far from a big Confederate monument. The contradiction. The most notable marker honors Harriet Jacobs, a local woman who escaped slavery via the Maritime Underground Railroad. Jacobs went on to write one of the few known slave narratives, Incidents in the Life of a Slave Girl, in 1861, and became a revered abolitionist. Edenton historical interpreter Charles Boyette tells me that the Maritime Underground Railroad was a hidden network of connections and safe houses that allowed enslaved persons to seek their freedom along the waterways. He says that Edenton was part of a network for thousands who escaped to the north with the help of sailors, dock workers, fishermen, both free and enslaved, and others who made their living off the water and waterfront. I'd never heard of the Maritime Underground Railroad. I wondered whether my 12 and 13-year-old nieces, Shy and Wu Murphy, who live only about 30 minutes away in the next town over, know about it. They don't. Yarborough Sanders, the genealogist, calls on Zoom. She has results. First, it turns out Jack bought even more land than my grandfather, at least 174 acres in total. Maybe it's in the family because I managed to buy three homes by the time I was 31. Second, he was a delegate to the 1865 Freedmen's Convention in Raleigh, a statewide assembly that took place after the end of the Civil War, to consider aspirations and goals for the formerly enslaved. That resonates. He tried to be part of the solution despite the odds against him. Finally, there was evidence that Jack fought in the Civil War in the United States Colored Troops, 2nd Regiment, Company B. Yarborough Sanders smiles at me. If that's your ancestor, it's a huge big deal. She also tells me with laughter that he may have owned a speakeasy. I feel a stirring of pride. I am not a descendant of sad people, of victims, of faithless people. Jack has become real to me, not perfect, just real, as has Edenton. Turns out I am in Edenton on June 19, 2021, Juneteenth, the day the federal government just made an official holiday to celebrate the freedom of those who were enslaved. Oh, how the universe works. And Edenton celebrates all out with a soulful band, vendors, and food stalls right at the river. People of different races are communing. That evening, there is a vigil at the Confederate Monument to get rid of the negative energy of plantation culture and bring in positive vibrations. Curious eyes follow me as I walk around with all my recording equipment. People ask who I am and who my people are. And now I can say I am of Jack Roberts' clan. Jack begot John H., who begot John A., who begot Lula, who begot me. And there is recognition, laughter stories from the past of my mom, my Aunt Myrtle, my Uncle George, my Uncle Sonny. Carol Anthony, a stranger passing by, upon hearing my name, tells me she is married to my Uncle Teeny's stepson. How did I not know this place? Many African cultures believe that ancestors never die, never lose their connection with the living, that their energy is still there supporting us, pushing us, loving us. What if, I think, all African Americans could look back and claim their past, see their ancestors fully, know their whole story? Would that change everything? I'm not a scientist or a historian, I'm a storyteller, and I can now see that the stories we find as we discover ourselves don't just belong to us as individuals. They also belong to the communities of which we are a part. And if those groups are brave, they can use those stories to expand the possibility of who we might all become together. This history, our history has sad notes. Like any good love story, it has pain and hurt. But this history, black history, American history, also has lifting notes, crescendos, full orchestras that tug at the heart and make it soar. I thought this search for slave ships might be hard. I thought I would need hands holding mine, rubbing my back, consoling my tears and my heartache. Instead, I found strength and power and adventure and camaraderie. I found laughter and love, life, kinship. I found something strong and necessary to root and ground me. All from a picture in a museum. Welcome home. Quite an article there, huh? Well, we're going to conclude Tara Roberts' we're now going to conclude part two of the In the Depths by reading the last of Liz Johnson's feature story that we began with a few minutes ago. And this is, of course, about Tara Roberts and her search for her family roots, and let's read the final paragraphs of this. This section's titled The Journey Continues. Through Into the Depths, Roberts has shared the story she set out to tell when she first saw the Diving with a Purpose photo, but her journey is far from over. There's more to talk about and more to uncover, Roberts said. I think there's a longer story about this. Roberts still considers herself a global citizen, and she hopes to continue traveling for the foreseeable future. But something is different now. She's found the place she feels rooted, the place she calls home. I always thought that it would be somewhere outside the United States, Roberts said. I was searching all over the world for something that I've had all along. No matter how far she travels, Edenton will be waiting for her. It changes everything. And to learn more about Tara Roberts and Into the Depths, you can go to natgeo.com. That's natgeo.com. So there we go, the story of Tara Roberts and her family with close connections there in northeastern North Carolina community of Edenton. Well, as we learned from the National Geographic story, research is continuing on the wreck of the last U.S. slave ship, which was discovered mostly intact on the Alabama coast. Associated Press writer Jay Reeves' article appeared in the December 23, 2022 issue of the News and Observer. Let's see what Jay has to tell us. Dateline, Birmingham, Alabama. Researchers studying the wreckage of the last U.S. slave ship buried in mud on the Alabama coast since it was scuttled in 1860 have made the surprising discovery that most of the wooden schooner remains intact, including the pen that was used to imprison African captives during the brutal journey across the Atlantic Ocean. While the upper portion of the two-masted Clotilda is gone, the section below the deck where the captured Africans and stockpiles were held is still largely in one piece after being buried for decades in a section of river that hasn't been dredged, said maritime archaeologist James Delgado of the Florida-based Search Incorporated. At least two-thirds of the ship remains, and the existence of the unlit and unventilated slave pen, built during the voyage by the addition of a bulkhead where people were held as cargo below the main deck for weeks, raises questions about whether food and water containers, chains, and even human DNA could remain in the hull, said Delgado. It's a stunning revelation, he said in an interview. The discovery enhances the research value of the Clotilda's remains and sets them apart from all other wrecks, Delgado said. The finding was confirmed in a report that was provided to the Associated Press and led to the site becoming part of the National Register of Historic Places in November. It's the most intact slave ship wreck ever, he said. It's because it's sitting in the Mobile Tensaw Delta with fresh water and in mud that protected it while it's still there. For Joycelyn Davis, a sixth-generation granddaughter of African captive Charlie Lewis and vice president of the Clotilda Descendants Association, the story of what happened more than 160 years ago is best told through the people who were involved, not a sunken ship. But she said she's excited to learn more about what has been discovered, adding, I think it's going to be a surprise for us all. The Clotilda was the last ship known to transport African captives to the American South for enslavement. Nearly 90 feet, or 27 meters in length, it departed Mobile, Alabama for an illegal trip to purchase people decades after Congress outlawed such trade in 1808. The ship had been sent across the ocean on a voyage financed by a wealthy businessman whose descendants remain prominent in Mobile. The Clotilda's captain transferred its human cargo off the ship once it arrived in Alabama and set fire to the vessel to hide evidence of the journey. But most of the ship didn't catch fire and remained in the river. Shown on navigational charts since the 1950s, the wreckage was publicly identified as that of Clotilde in 2019 and has been explored and researched since then, Delgado said. The state has set aside $1 million for preservation and research, and additional work planned at the site in early 2022 could show what's inside the hull, Delgado said. But far more work is needed to determine whether the ship could ever be pulled out of the mud and put on display, as some have suggested. Generally, raising is a very expensive proposition. My sense is that while it has survived, it is more fragile than people think, said Delgado. A recovery could be a very delicate operation and also a very expensive and lengthy process. Freed after the South lost the Civil War, some of the enslaved Africans who were transported to America on the Clotilde settled in a community they started called Africatown, USA, a few miles north of downtown Mobile. A documentary about the now impoverished community by Alabama-born filmmaker Margaret Brown titled Descendant will premiere at the Sundance Film Festival in January, and descendants of the Clotilde captives are planning an annual gathering in February. Work is underway on a new museum that's meant to be a catalyst for tourism and new development in the area. Now, in an article originally written for the Washington Post, writer Terrence McCoy found that more enslaved Africans came to the Americas through this port than anywhere else. Why have so few heard of it? His article appeared in the January 18, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer, and I'll read the caption of a photograph that precedes the article to give us an idea of what this is all about. Two tourists walk along the Valongo Wharf in Rio de Janeiro. The site has been considered the most important physical trace of the arrival of enslaved Africans to the Americas. At the height of the transatlantic slave trade, nearly 1 million enslaved Africans arrived on its cobbled stones, like anywhere else in the world, and twice as many as were trafficked to all the United States. Let's begin. Dateline Rio de Janeiro. When we tour guide Pedros Andres arrives at the site historians call the most important physical evidence of the arrival of enslaved Africans to the Americas, the scene he found was familiar. The Valongo Wharf was empty. Addressing a family of Paraguayan tourists, Andres described its historic significance. At the height of the transatlantic slave trade, nearly 1 million enslaved Africans arrived on its cobbled stones, likely more than anywhere else in the world, and twice as many as were trafficked to all of the United States. UNESCO has called the wharf, discovered in 2011 during an urban renovation project, a unique and exceptional place that carries enormous historical as well as spiritual importance to African Americans. But Andres, who brings tourists to the wharf out of his own volition, and not because it's recommended by his tour agency, saw little indication of that remarkable history. There are no memorials, only a single sign above a large puddle far removed from the street. The wharf has been unearthed, but it is still ignored. Even people who live nearby, whose ancestry leads back to this point, don't know of its existence. Sad, said Andres, 26, sad that slavery ever happened, but also sad that its history is being neglected. Now that history is honored at the site, and who gets to make those decisions are questions at the core of another struggle over race and memory in the country that brought the most enslaved Africans into the Americas. The dispute, which pits federal prosecutors and historians against the right-wing presidency of Jair Bolsonaro, echoes an ongoing racial reckoning in Brazil that in recent years has taken on some of the country's darkest moments and most enduring contradictions. Brazil historically has demurred on questions of race, preferring instead to understand itself through the lens of class. Its intellectual elite have long described the country as a racial democracy forged by intermarriage and unencumbered by the racism plaguing other countries. But it has also imported nearly 5 million enslaved Africans, an estimated 40% of the transatlantic slave trade, and in 1888 was the last country in the hemisphere to abolish slavery. Historians, federal prosecutors, and advocates for racial justice say the Valongo Wharf presents a unique opportunity for Brazil to fully address that original sin and the racial inequality it imparted. But they say the government under Bolsonaro has failed to meet the historic moment, perhaps intentionally, and Brazil is once more choosing to ignore the injustices of its past. The least that Brazil can do is recognize this crime against humanity, said Brazilian anthropologist Milton Guerin, who worked on the UNESCO World Heritage application for the site. The Valongo Wharf is a way to recognize that Brazil was the country that most received enslaved people and therefore is the country that has the greatest debt to Africa and the descendants here who represent the largest black population outside of Africa, he said. But instead, federal prosecutors alleged in a lawsuit filed in September, the government has failed to honor commitments made during the administration of President Michel Temer in 2017 when UNESCO recognized the wharf. A tourism welcome center has not been built. Almost all of the African artifacts that have been recovered, rings, amulets, religious items, remain locked away out of sight. The site itself has at times been littered with trash or flooded. The drainage system has repeatedly malfunctioned. A city worker was electrocuted in 2020 while trying to drain the site. The United States and Chinese utility company have each donated $500,000, but the money has yielded few improvements. There is still no concrete management plan for the site. All of this depends on the federal government, federal prosecutor Sergio Gardenghe Suama told the Washington Post. But the federal government today hasn't met its commitment to work with the local community, let alone advance an anti-racist agenda to honor its African heritage. Bolsonaro's office deferred comment to the National Institute of Historic and Artistic Heritage, the federal agency charged with overseeing the site. The institute declined an interview last week and did not respond to written questions. The biggest point of contention has been dissolution of the site's Civic Management Committee. It was assembled to give the local community, specifically Afro-Brazilians, a chance to advise and oversee government officials working on the site. But the group was disbanded in 2019 when Bolsonaro dissolved many such committees to help de-bureaucratize the Brazilian government. The presidential decree Bolsonaro tweeted at the time was to reduce the power of politically equipped entities that use beautiful names to impose their will, ignore the law, and purposely slow down Brazil's development. But the elimination of the Wharfs Committee left black community members feeling excluded and without a voice in the site's management. This isn't neglect, said Luiz Owado Negrogan, who sat on the committee. This is a coordinated, clear, and explicitly racist action to deconstruct and undo our attempts to rescue the site. He added, I'm not sad. I have a hate that runs deep. In legal filings, the Federal Heritage Institute that oversees the wharf defended its management and said improvements were on the way. The agency said it was under no international obligation to work with the Civic Management Committee. The local community can still participate in the site's management, it said, by attending public meetings and following the agency's online news page. There is no plan by the Brazilian government to impede the participation of the interested community, the institute said in court documents. The absence of the management committee does not imply there is an absence of management. So there you go. What's happening lately in a very historic moment in the story of slavery. Well, that brings us to the end of this journey on this episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.